Hello and welcome to another Future of Real Estate podcast. I'm Damien Wild. It's been a roller coaster of a week, another roller coaster of a week. HMV was brought back from the brink of format oblivion by Canadian music retailer Sunrise Records. And what is immediately clear is that the vision of the future held by Sunrise's Doug Putnam is very different to that held by many. We know the physical media business is here to stay, he said this week. And in that, he shares the view of the similarly acquisitive Mike Ashley, who had also been in the running to purchase the retailer. It was also a week that saw a shopping centre go to auction at £1. The hammer fell at the Allsop auction at the Barclay Hotel on Tuesday at £310,000, reflecting a yield of over 50%. A private investor, bidding over the telephone, is the new owner of the postings in Kirkcaldy. My colleague Sam McClary was in the room and watched bidding for the lot begin at £10, and it took just a few minutes to reach its final sale price. You may also have seen EG's retail analyst James Child on the BBC talking about the sale. Given the shopping centre last sold for £10.3 million in 2003, his money is on an alternative use. Isla St Clair opened the centre in 1981. Some of you may have to ask who Isla St Clair is. I wonder if she might cut the ribbon on the residential that will surely be part of a new scheme in just a few years' time. Landlords and employees of HMV will be trusting that Putnam and Sunrise can establish a viable business. Residents and businesses in Kirkcaldy will be trusting that the as-yet-unnamed new owner of the postings will be sensitive to their needs. We discussed trust at length on this podcast last week, and I make no apology for returning to it so quickly. It continues to matter so much. Just after we recorded last week's podcast, Grosvenor Britain and Ireland CEO Craig McWilliam took to the stage at the Building London Summit. He was unusually candid about the industry's trust problem. "We accept we need to change to grow public trust," he said. And tonight, we're likely to see evidence of why that trust needs to be restored. Grosvenor's £500 million planning application for the old biscuit factory scheme in Bermondsey is going to committee, and it looks likely to be rejected. I asked Craig about that, but began by asking him about trust. So, Craig, welcome to the EG studio. Has the industry got a trust problem?
Yes, it has. I mean, I don't think we can deny that. We saw in that BPF survey that you mentioned in your article last week that, the vast majority of the industry doesn't believe we're trusted. And also doesn't believe that the system we use to work, the planning system, is trusted either.
So untrusted rather than untrustworthy. To what extent is it deserved, and how do we turn it around?
I think that part of the trust comes from the fact that people see growth and development and planning as things that happen to them, not for them. So London's grown enormously in the last 10 or 20 years, and people don't necessarily see the benefit from that growth. They don't understand who it was for. They don't know how those decisions were made. And so they've lost faith in the process that delivers it and the actors who've been involved. And we see that in all the trust barometers. It's not just the property industry and the planning system, but it's also the politicians who are our kind of counterparts, our, you know, co-ventures in that process.
Yeah, we live in a time, don't we, where there is little trust in big organisations, in institutions, in politicians, in businesses in many cases, although, you know, there has been some evidence recently that perhaps trust in one's employer is coming to the fore. And I just wonder whether that creates an opportunity, whether there is something to capitalise upon now for the property industry to try and re-engage and win back public trust.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, people trust each other. I mean, when we engage with people or with an organisation, we generally end up trusting that more. And so, actually, firstly, the industry is in a place where, you know, we need to change in order to be able to carry on fulfilling our purpose. And the fact that it's become so difficult to carry out our role because of this lack of trust gives us an opportunity to do something differently. I mean, you know, we're on the brink, we can't move forwards, therefore we've got to find a new way. And we should see that as an opportunity born out of this, you know, crisis of trust that we do see across all sectors. And the second thing, of course, is, you know, property is a local experience, isn't it? I mean, it happens in a place locally. And what we're trying to do is create trust locally. And so there's this fantastic opportunity to actually engage with the communities that we are impacting
in a way which is more sincere. And we know that when we do that, when anybody engages locally and actually listens, the people who are speaking feel heard, and that builds trust.
So this isn't rocket science, is it? Why hasn't it been happening?
No. Well, for a very long time, of course, I think the industry found that you didn't need to do this. I mean, the history of planning and development was that it was quite a technical process, quite a political process. It happened behind closed doors. I mean, there was a time in modern history where you didn't even have to tell the owner of a site that you were off getting planning consent for it. There was certainly no public consultation.
Some progress
there. So yeah, absolutely, lots of progress. But so the industry has seen it as a professional and technical process that didn't need to involve people. And, you know, if that worked, then everyone just did that. But it doesn't work anymore. And so, you know, there's been all sorts of moves to try and create engagement of the public in the planning process. Ben Rogers from Centre of London touched yesterday on the fact that the last time the government looked into this was 50 years ago, in the end of the 1960s. And there have been experiments, but, you know, none of them have taken root. The industry has carried on with its traditional process. And so now we've got to a point where it's become very difficult to carry on.
Okay, so 50 years without looking at it in great detail, but you said earlier that it has reached a point where it's making it very difficult to do development now. And we've seen some headline examples of that, from Elephant Castle to Earl's Court and to Bermondsey, your own scheme there. You know, we're in the week where you go in for planning there. It looks like it's going to be problematic. How do you, by re-engaging and winning back trust, how do you take a scheme like Bermondsey forward?
Yeah, no, it's very good. So the hearing is this evening. The recommendation from the officers is for a refusal, but obviously we don't know what the decision will be. We've worked very hard to talk to both the very local community, but also to Southwark as an authority about the benefits that our scheme brings. And it's a build-to-rent scheme, and it's designed to try and create housing for, you know, the majority of normal Londoners who are unable to buy but aren't ever going to be allocated, you know, social housing, because there's just so little social housing available. And so we're trying to address that, you know, that squeeze middle. But inevitably, the economics of that are that a build-to-rent scheme doesn't produce as much profit as a build-for-sale scheme, and therefore it doesn't deliver as much affordable housing as the local authority would aspire to. But the trouble is, you know, if the local authority don't talk about those trade-offs within their own borough, about where the benefits of development are being invested by them, because that's the nature of the process, what public benefits are accruing and who's getting them, then on the ground, people just hear a very binary argument about how, you know, developers aren't contributing enough. But, you know, what's enough? Private development isn't ever going to be able to solve all of London's problems. And so we have to see our public sector leaders actually talk about those trade-offs and explain what they're trying to achieve and where those benefits are going to be invested. And I suppose in Southwark, you know, I regret that the benefits that a build-to-rent scheme can bring more broadly are not being talked about, only the fact that a scheme like that cannot deliver as much affordable housing as a for-sale scheme, which would deliver homes that the majority of people who live and work around the site would never be able to afford.
Okay, well, we will follow closely what yep. happens there. And it may be too early to ask what you might have done differently to see those benefits more transparently explained. But what learnings do you take from it into another big scheme, or perhaps a reapplication here?
I think that, you know, it's a scheme where, on the ground, I believe it's fair to say that there's a lot of support for what we're doing, for how the development would reintegrate communities, how it would create connections between different physical areas through barriers at the moment, the rail viaducts and the connections to the tube would improve, and everyone aspires to see that happen. The challenge is whether, as a city, we are having the kind of conversation about housing, what the private sector can do, what the public sector can do, and that needs public sector leadership. I mean, it's a challenge, I suppose, for the mayor to articulate and for borough leaders to articulate what's possible. but not get lost in this binary debate, because otherwise, you know, we just see nothing happen. And that's a corrosive to London's growth generally, because, you know, if actually political leaders set up a very binary argument, trust is only eroded. And if for every political leader who stands up and says developers are not doing enough, the public don't hear a nuanced argument about, you know, where the surplus profit from development is captured and invested, about the viability of development in a city like London. They only hear this very binary argument, and that just reduces trust even further. So the industry has to talk. The industry has to be more transparent. I'm in favour of, you know, the viability process being entirely transparent. The fact that in many cases it's still done behind closed doors corrodes public trust. I would love to see a broader conversation about where the benefits of development are invested. So I was at a meeting yesterday and somebody from Soho spoke out about how if a particular building was redeveloped, they'd want to see a new health centre built with the proceeds, the surplus of development. But of course, actually, I said to him, the trouble is the planning policy means that the only public benefit that would be created is affordable housing. And actually, the local community there don't want affordable housing. They want, you know, a walk-in health centre.
So there are policy impediments as well.
There are policy impediments. And the industry can't solve those alone. It's got to be transparent about where benefit's being created, how much benefit, how much profit is being created, what profit the industry makes, what surplus goes to the public. But then we also need to see public leaders stand up and explain those trade-offs, accept that development can't do everything, and engage the public in a conversation about what they do want to see.
Okay, and you're trying to engage the public in that conversation.
Yeah, so we've begun what we think is one of the largest ever pollings of public opinion about trust in development, and we are asking questions about not only do people trust the development process, but also how could developers help create greater trust? What could happen that would boost transparency in the process? What does the public sector need to do? And we're asking members of the public. We're also asking you know, political leaders, politicians, planning officers, to get a really broad range of views. And we're going to go through that, the results of that, and look for the best ideas, and then take one of our own schemes and try out those ideas, engage with the public in a way which is much more open, be clear about what we have to get from a project in order to be able to take it forward, but also, you know, try and actually reflect what the local community say they want.
And when you talk to your peers, other CEOs, do they say, you know, that's a great idea, Craig, we'd love to emulate that, or do they say, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah, I think, look, my sense is that everybody I talk to sees the need to change, but I think we all, as an industry, fear the difficulty of that transition. I mean, it's a you know, it's a hard job to do, isn't it? Our experience as an industry is when you ask, you know, what do you think about this development, people just say, I hate it all, everywhere, all the time. And that's because actually, unfortunately, at the moment, the only people who engage are the people who want to say no. And we've got this massive problem as an industry of trying to engage people who might say yes, or might say yes if I get this, to try and explain to the broad community, you know, what's going on, who's benefiting, and how. So the risk is that those early steps that we take are just really hard, and you know, I'm sure there'll be knockbacks, but an organization like ours, you know, we ought to be able to try and do that and see if an example can be found that works.
So you suggested earlier that things had got pretty bad and it's going to be hard to move forward without a degree of change here. The political environment is pretty fraught at the moment. You know, the economics aren't you know, aren't perhaps as favourable as they were recently. Is that an obstacle to change, or does that create an opportunity to change?
I think it creates an imperative to change. We can't wait. I mean, as an industry, we can't wait until the political environment and the market is perfect. You know, there's a real need.
Maybe the industry would be more reluctant to engage with change at that point.
Well, that might be true. I mean, if everything's going fine and you're able to give everybody what they want, then the imperative to change is gone. We're not in that situation. There's real pressure on development. There's real pressure on housing in London. And for every, you know, every significant property investor and developer in London needs London to be a success in order for their investments to be successful. So no one is immune from this, you know, this big challenge that we've all got. And, you know, we can't wait for politicians to solve this for us. We have to try and, you know, put our own house in order and engage. There's a lot of things that we can do. And I hope, actually, that that will help politicians engage too. I mean, my conversation with most local local authority leaders and politicians is that they would love to see a more balanced conversation about the pros and cons of development. But of course, it's in a very difficult environment at the moment.
And you talked about London there. I was at the party conferences last autumn, and we held a couple of dinners there. And one of the developers, it was Tom Bloxham of Urban Splash, actually, when we were talking about, is regeneration a dirty word? He said, it may be a dirty word in London, but I know in Manchester, people will be saying, bring me some of that regeneration, please. Is this a London problem?
I think it's more of a London problem because of the intensity of development and economic activity that goes on here. So the communities in London feel a level of, you know, pressure from growth that maybe is not felt in other cities. Those other cities are still seeing growth as a benefit that brings something real for them, new jobs, new homes. In London, we need those new jobs and new homes, but it is very hard to do that, to balance all those different pressures in a city that's grown as significantly as London. Regeneration, has it become a dirty word? I mean, it's got a lot of political overtones, and unfortunately, the benefits of regeneration are, you know, not always felt equally. That's the problem.
Okay, and with your own project, with the environment that we talked about out there, are you optimistic that change can come?
I am, because actually, I think, you know, we've got to a point where it's going to be very hard to go forward. So I'm optimistic because I see a chance to do it in a different way. And that excites me. I think people will want to engage. We will find different answers. We will get knockbacks. It won't be easy. But neither is the status quo. You know, carrying on as we have been doing is not going to continue to be successful in this environment. So the opportunity for people to work differently, create a better reputation for our industry, get greater public engagement. It's such a fundamental part of our society. I mean, the built environment is where the vast majority of us live and will continue to live. And a great city is a wonderful thing. And I think, therefore, I'm very optimistic about being able to continue to improve it.
Tonight's planning committee will be closely watched, but trust will continue to be a dominant issue in the months ahead. And we'll be covering it here on the Future of Real Estate podcast. Do join me again next week.